I'm Marty Mosco, and welcome back to Radio Times. Pennsylvania House Majority Leader Mike Terzai, Republican from Allegheny County, made some waves when he spoke at a meeting of the Pennsylvania Republican State Committee last weekend. Here's what he said.
We are focused on making sure that we meet our obligations that we've talked about for years. Pro-Second Amendment, the Castle Doctrine's done. First pro-life legislation, abortion facility regulations in 22 years, done. Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Critics of the new voter ID law pounce, saying that Terzai's comment revealed that the law was more about voter suppression than voter fraud. We hope to speak with House Majority Leader Mike Terzai during this hour. We're also going to talk about the Pennsylvania budget. A few days before the start of the new fiscal year, the legislature has not passed a new budget yet. We'll talk about all of this with our guests Laura Olson and John Baer. Laura is Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And Laura, nice to have you back with us on Radio Time.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us, John Baer, political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. His blog, Baer Growls, can be found at philly.com. And John, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having me. Hey, Laura.
Indeed, we're happy to have you here. And as I said, we're hoping to hear from Mike Terzai sometime during this hour. He's apparently in a meeting. But John, what do you make of the comments that he made over the weekend?
Well, it's interesting when you talk to Democrats or others who oppose the law, the first thing they say is, what's new about that? I mean, there was, from the beginning, Marty, as you know, always the assertion on the part of Democratic leaders, particularly very political Democratic leaders, that the law always was intended to suppress the block of voters that would be most affected by any new restrictions on voting. And those would be, of course, people who live in urban areas, who don't drive a car, who are older and maybe don't have photo IDs, who are poor, don't have photo IDs. And so you're putting essentially a roadblock to their access to the voting booth. Now, I wrote back in March when the governor signed this law that both sides exaggerate its impact. I really don't think it will have much of an impact. And Democrats who do ought to take it upon themselves to inform their electorate, to inform their base that this is the law, this is how you comply with it, and we're going to help you get photo IDs. But it was for Terzai not a surprise. He is given to just, you know, that's
what he does.
That kind of a statement. And it created a firestorm. I mean, it went viral, it went national. Every cable talk show in America was talking about it. And that's what you get when you speak the truth.
Well, do you see it that way, Laura?
What that comment first reminded me of was the comment that the governor made a couple days before the general election in 2010, where he was speaking, I think it was an audience out in the Philadelphia area, where he was talking about how we want to keep the turnout down. And Democrats kind of had a similar reaction to that. He was hoping for a strong Republican turnout and voters to help push him over the line. I don't think anyone thought he was actually trying to actively suppress the vote, but it was something that came out and Democrats immediately latched on to. I mean, I agree with John that I don't think the bill is going to have quite the impact that the Democrats say. It's harder to believe that it also, if you take what Mike Terzai is saying at his word, that it's going to have enough of an impact that it's going to sway an entire presidential election over to the Republicans. That's a lot of voter fraud to be assuming is in Pennsylvania at the moment.
Well, because there's about a million difference between the numbers of Democrats in Pennsylvania and the numbers of Republicans. And we know from some recent polling that Obama's about 5-6 points ahead of Romney. That would be a lot of voter impersonation in order to change those numbers, Laura.
And the tricky part is it's hard to see afterwards how we're going to know whether this has worked or not, because right now we don't have any cases of actual voter impersonation. We have some fraudulent registration arrests, some other incidents leading up to the election, but no one's been able to point and say that person impersonated another voter in the past. And afterwards, it's going to be hard to compare and see whether this is to judge its success.
Well, and John, not to relitigate this, and we did several shows about the voter ID law, but it seems to me that even the supporters and even Terzai, who I hope to speak with, they don't have evidence of voter impersonation, and that's what they're really talking about, and that's what they say this voter ID bill is supposed to fix.
Well, that's right, Marty, and the other point that I specifically asked Terzai about right before the law passed was, you know, why do you think that there is voter fraud? And he said, well, because it's not being enforced, particularly in large Democratic-controlled urban areas where this is targeted to. So my next question was, well, if they're not enforcing that law, what makes you think they would enforce this law? And there really is no answer for that. So, again, as Laura suggested, it's going to be, I think the impact is going to be small, and it's going to be very difficult to determine if this law actually does anything.
Laura, is there polling on this voter ID law? Is there support for it in Pennsylvania? Do you know?
I believe there's been polling. I'm not remembering off the top of my head. But we do have a couple of lawsuits pending on this already. And so this is something that's going to be going before the court system as well, which is important to point out. In July, there's going to be a hearing, and the Senate Democratic Caucus is taking a look at the August special election, they say, to see how what kind of data they can gather from that and then decide whether they also want to sue on behalf of some voters they believe will be impacted.
Marty, there is polling on this, and it's enormous. People, by overwhelming majorities, are in favor of it. And the reason for that is because it sounds very reasonable. You just say, look, I need voter ID to get on an airplane. I need voter ID at my bank. I need voter ID in 100 places. Why shouldn't I need it to vote? And the answer is twofold. Number one, the people who are being polled are most likely not people who are poor, elderly, or without photo IDs. And number two, there are equally huge numbers if you poll Pennsylvanians and say, would you like recall elections? The same people who point to the poll on voter ID and say, this is why we ought to have it, I am 100% certain would not point to the polling on recall elections and support that because of the polls.
Oh, interesting. Well, let me segue into the budget negotiations. And Laura, I'll go back to you. Where do things stand today? And, of course, we know the fiscal year starts this weekend. Corbett's only been in office a couple of years, but he's, unlike his predecessor, he at least last year had an on-time budget. What's the chance for an on-time budget this year?
Well, the chance is getting smaller and smaller as the minutes tick away here, but we're still hoping to see some action on a state spending plan later today. The House was expected to begin debate on this final budget agreement for a $27.66 billion spending plan last night. They never got a chance to take that up. They left for the evening, but were expected to take it up today, and are still saying that they intend to have that bill and possibly a few others passed by Saturday's deadline. There's still a lot on the to-do list because there's some tax bills and revenue bills that they have to pass along with that spending bill in order to make it work. And there are some lingering issues on some education reform bills that they're also hoping to get through before that deadline.
And John, what's the governor doing, I guess, to try to get his Republican legislature moving on this?
Everything he can. He even gave up going to the Pirates Phillies, which for him is a give.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
This is a prime objective. You know, he has stressed from his campaign to as recently as the other day that he is not his predecessor. He is not Ed Rendell. He makes the trains run on time. So it's a big deal for him, at least in terms of perspective. The truth is, if this were to bleed over into Sunday, Monday, I mean, you're looking at a holiday weekend.
Right.
As long as the casinos stay open, as long as the state parks stay open, nobody outside of the cocoon of Harrisburg is going to care if it's a couple of days late. But there is a big push to get it done on time.
But are there divisions between the Republican governor and the Republican majorities in the House and Senate, John?
Not as much as obviously there are between the Democrats and the governor and the majorities. I mean, we are down to the point, I'm told, of just kind of fine-tuning a couple of things, particularly on block grants to county and sewing up that big Shell petrochemical deal.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly, I mean, I think they are now on the same page in terms of how much to spend and how much to hold back.
Laura, let me go to you and talk a bit about general assistance, which has gotten a fair amount of publicity here in Philadelphia. A lot of people depend on about $200 a month from the budget. Is that going to be, in a sense, removed from the budget?
Well, in addition to the $150 million reduction that got a lot of attention as soon as the governor's budget was out, this final plan includes even a slight further reduction in that. So there's no restoration for those general assistance dollars in this final plan.
And affecting certainly people in Philadelphia, I'm assuming affecting people in Pittsburgh as well.
Absolutely, and we've gotten a lot of calls and a lot of emails on that, saying that this is something that's important that we rely on. And there have been a lot of places where the money got added back in over the governor's plan in higher education. Mm-hmm. There are some block grants for kindergarten programs that got restored to the current year's level, but the general assistance line will not get additional dollars.
John, get us up to speed on this whole petrochemical deal.
Well, I mean, it was badly managed from the start, and if you talk to administration insiders privately, they will acknowledge that. The problem, Marty, was they had a confidentiality agreement with Shell not to talk about any specifics. Where they made their mistake was not going to Shell and saying, look, we want to drive this story, what can we say? When it broke as a surprise. And it was immediately, because of the void, it was immediately painted as a corporate giveaway. The truth of it is that it won't affect a nickel of state spending for 5 years. All they're doing now is putting the plan in place to show Shell, we're going to do this, so go ahead and build that billion-dollar plant out there and open at least the possibility for tens of thousands of jobs. The reticence on the part of critics of Corbett and critics of government, period, are they look back at other big proposals like the Caverner proposal to rebuild the shipyard in Philadelphia and say, look, I mean, the state put a ton of money in that. We were supposed to get thousands of jobs. Never really happened. How do we know that this one will? So it is, on the one hand, a huge investment in the future, particularly for Western Pennsylvania. On the other hand, there are always skeptics who say that these big government programs, and remember, this is a party that wants less government involvement, and so they put this out as a partnership for the betterment of the state, for the long-term economy. And I think he has it together. I mean, I think when you're a Republican governor and you have both chambers on your side, I imagine it's going to pass.
Well, we're talking about pretty generous tax breaks at a time when the state is having to make budget cuts. And doesn't that make it a little more dicey, John?
Well, sure, it makes it dicey because it was badly handled. I mean, the way to handle it is you point out that there isn't a penny coming out of this budget or out of any programs for social welfare or for education. This is something that would kick in 5 years if Shell meets all the requirements, and it is performance-based. It is tied to the amount of ethane gas that is actually sold, and logically you can assume that would mean, you know, more jobs. The more product is sold, the more jobs you would need and the more industries that would spring up around it. So it's one of those things that's going to take time. It's $65 million a year starting 5 years from now.
And that's John Baer, political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. Also with us is Laura Olson, Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And Laura, I'll give you a chance to weigh in on that after this very short break. You can give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, talking about Pennsylvania politics and the budget. We'll be right back.
Time is marching on, and time is still marching on. WHYY will stop marching to the end of our fiscal year this Saturday night. What does this mean for you? Well, if you haven't become a WHYY supporter yet, right now is the time to do it. Your contributions help WHYY close out this fiscal year soundly and start the next one strong. Support WHYY with a generous end-of-year financial gift right now at WHYY.org.
Squash vine borers and flea beetles can take quite a bite out of your produce production. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the clever tricks two listeners devised to stop these pests. Plus, a tomato blight update and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Yeah. funny man Gabriel Iglesias is one of the most watched comedians on YouTube. But when we asked him to join us, he was a bit surprised.
When they said they wanted me to do an interview with NPR, I'm like, I hope they know I didn't, barely graduated high school.
Gabriel Iglesias joins us in the next installment of our summer series, Make Me Laugh. Next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking about the Pennsylvania state budget, Pennsylvania politics with John Baer, political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, and Laura Olson, Harrisburg bureau chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And about 20 minutes or so, we're going to shift gears and talk about this Supreme Court decision earlier this morning upholding the Affordable Care Act. We also want to take your calls at 1-888-477-9499. Laura, do you want to just weigh in on this tax for Shell and how that's, I guess, playing out politically?
Yeah, Don covered a lot of the highlights there. But one thing that's really struck me is that the governor has come out and done a really aggressive sales pitch since the news first leaked out. That John pointed out that wasn't the way that they really would have preferred that this tax credit proposal be introduced. But since then, he's been holding several press conferences in different parts of the state. He had one in Harrisburg last week with labor, with business leaders, with Democrats, with Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald was out there with him. And so they're really making this strong showing of support to back this up. And we've seen administration staffers working the lawmakers in the hallways this week. So it does seem like this is something that they've put a lot of effort into, but also, have been making a fairly reasoned argument and have some support behind them from both sides of the aisle so far.
Is it unusual for the governor to be so proactive on an issue like this?
Often he's been more of a behind the scenes guy, and so this is becoming more of something that he's done to come out and make the sales pitch, but not something that came naturally to him last year when he first took office.
John, going back to you, and there have been some polling about Governor Corbett's popularity. It has fallen, I guess, in the last year or so, probably based on the fact that there have been some pretty draconian cuts in public education, and certainly looking at the state's system of higher education also been on the chopping block. Does that surprise you that the public is at least not as happy with the governor as they were when they voted him into office?
Well, I really put that on him. I mean, he, in terms of programs and policy, he is doing exactly what he said he would do as a candidate. And the state Senate, particularly, has kind of rolled him back a little bit from those draconian cuts. I mean, the education money has been flatlined, not reduced. The higher ed money has been flatlined, not reduced. And he's gone along with that. And I think in the broadest possible picture, when people, after this budget gets done and there's no new taxes in it again, and it's basically on time, I think his numbers will start to bump up again, because people, I think, are very suspect of government. And we're at a place where, the government that governs least is probably governing best. And every governor, Marty, as you know, has a rough year or two, because it's more than a notion to govern a state the size of Pennsylvania with all the diversity and all the different ideology. But I think he's kind of getting a little set in the saddle now. As Laura says, he's been out very aggressively on Shell. I think we'll probably see more of him pushing the kinds of programs that he wants.
Laura, you had a piece recently about Marcellus Shale, the gas drilling in Pennsylvania, that there were at least reports or allegations of methane migration in Tioga County. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, there haven't been too many updates since then about where this situation is going in terms of the investigation, but there was an incident in Tioga County near some Shell Oil Company-owned well sites, and there was what looked to be incidents of methane migration in a nearby well where there was a water well with shooting, I guess, kind of a geyser into the air of, 10 or 20 feet high of water. And they were trying to figure out what was going on. There was some bubbling in a nearby creek. And so DEP and Shell have been doing two sets of water testing up there. They're trying to figure out what's going on and what is causing this. I mean, we've had methane migration issues in the past in northeastern Pennsylvania. I think a lot of your listeners will be familiar with the town of Dimock by now. This is something that the state has investigated before. In that case, it was faulty well casings. So far, we don't have any sort of source of the methane or any reason to explain why this was happening. And the part about the water shooting into the air was a little more unusual. I don't remember hearing about that in Dimock. And so we don't have any updates for now, but it was a not probably the headline that Shell wanted.
Indeed.
As the state government
Indeed.
Is debating this tax credit at the moment. So.
John, let me go back to you. And I noticed that the House voted to expand drilling on state university campuses. I hear a chuckle coming from you. Go ahead.
I mean, it is... It's drill, baby, drill. We already have about 600,000 acres of forest land available for drilling in Pennsylvania, and there's consideration of leasing other property, including land around our 27 state prisons. But the higher ed thing raised some eyebrows. I mean, because you just picture these wells on college quads and stuff like that. But it did pass the House, and it passed very comfortably, and is now headed to the Senate. And I think the argument gets back to finances. People are saying that this is a bill that would help the state's higher ed system to bring in more money, because they would get something like 40% of any royalties, and a portion of that, I think 15%. Laura can correct me. Has to be devoted to reducing tuition costs. So on the one hand, it sounds a little quirky and it sounds a little over-aggressive. On the other hand, as soon as you start talking about reducing tuition costs, you know, it's like if Verizon wants to put a tower in my backyard and pay me $1,000 a month, I'm happy to do it.
Is that true, John? You would do that?
Absolutely. You know the state of the newspaper business.
Well, that's true. That's true. But, Lauren, would this pass the Senate, do you think?
It already did. It needs to go back over for a concurrence vote to sign off on some of the changes, that 15% tuition appropriation that John mentioned was added in the House last week, and there was strong support over there as well. And there is one college campus at the moment, California University in Washington County, down the southwestern part of the state, and they do have a drilling lease already through their affiliated nonprofit. I don't believe there's any drilling yet, but they have leased, and so this would allow them to keep the money instead of all the money going back to state government. So as John said, that it's absolutely a revenue issue for these campuses.
Well, as John said, drill, baby, drill. That's Laura Olson Harrisburg, bureau chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. John Baer, political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. His blog, Baer Growls, can be found at philly.com. And we have called him up before when we talk about Pennsylvania politics. There are negotiations ongoing to come to some kind of agreement on the state budget. The deadline is tomorrow, and Governor Corbett has vowed that he wants this bill on time, unlike the previous governor, Ed Randell. I don't think he ever had a budget that was passed and signed on time. Talking about what's in this budget and some of the challenges facing the state as well, and the governor and the people who live here. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John, let me shift gears and go to a Supreme Court ruling earlier this week. The Supreme Court ruled on the Arizona immigration law, essentially throwing out three of the four provisions. Nonetheless, it was interesting that Daryl Metcalf said that this was the green light he was looking for to institute immigration laws in Pennsylvania modeled in part on Arizona. Help us understand his thinking on this issue, if you
can. Well, Daryl's thinking is a little bit to the right of the sheriff of Nottingham. I mean, he is a Republican from Butler County, probably the most conservative member of the entire legislature. And immigration has been a big issue for him for a number of years. The problem I have with it is we're not Arizona, you know, we're not Texas. I just don't see it being an issue that catches a lot of fire in Pennsylvania. If you look at the demographics, our state has less than 6% Hispanic or Latino residents, citizens. And that's less than a third of the national average. So I don't see it as anything that's going to get either the legislature or the citizenry, and certainly not the administration, too excited.
What do you think, Laura?
Well, right after that ruling, my colleague was at a Mitt Romney event that the governor was at, and while he answered some questions about the immigration ruling, he said he didn't quite have the fired-up answer that you would expect from someone like a Daryl Metcalf or someone like that on the more conservative end of the legislature. So I'd have to agree with John that it's probably not too far up on the administration's priority list.
Indeed. Well, let me shift to the Liquor Control Board. And John, I'll go back to you, but Laura, I'd like to hear from you as well. The Inspector General Office did an investigation of these administrative law judges work for the LCB. This was back in 2010. Nonetheless, found evidence of absenteeism, quote-unquote flexible work hours, long lunch breaks, people running errands during work hours, gym workouts. John, are you shocked?
I was. Shock. My biggest disappointment, there are six administrative judges. I was hoping there would be seven so we could cast them as the seven dwarves, most of them being sleepy. But it just didn't work out. Look, I mean, that's an agency that has been an anachronism for, you know, for 70 years or so, and it just kind of added fuel to those that want to do away with it and privatize the liquor system. The more troubling was the second report, Marty, that came out that showed that senior officials at the board had interacted with vendors and accepted gifts and lobbied them individually, which is in violation of the LCB's own regulations and possibly the ethics code. So we might see some further action in that area.
Do you think heads will roll, Laura?
It's hard to say. It always takes a little while around here, even for heads to roll. But when we talked to the governor the next day, he had very little to say and was pretty guarded. He did say that he hadn't yet seen these reports. So it may take a little while before we actually have anything to report on that.
And what does an administrative law judge do for the LCB? What is their job at the LCB? Does anyone know?
Well, apparently, John? It's to take vacation without signing up for it, walk the dog, go swimming, go on shopping trips.
They sit on
cases involving liquor violations, and there are many because there are too many liquor restrictions.
Oh, interesting. This is an awkward segue because this is a very serious issue. Obviously, the Sandusky trial and verdict. And let me go to you, Laura. What has been the impact of that verdict that came down, finding Jerry Sandusky guilty of most of the counts that he was charged with, a very disturbing case?
Absolutely. I think some of the attention in Harrisburg then has turned to some of the child abuse reporting laws that have been introduced. There were some that were introduced before this case came to light, and then some that also were added to the list after the charges against Mr. Sandusky came out. And so there's been a commission to look at the state's child abuse reporting laws and other laws for how these sorts of situations are handled. And there hasn't been any conclusion with those, but there were a couple of bills that have been moving forward through the legislature.
But, John, it seems like there's more to be investigated here.
A lot more to come. Stay tuned. I think the free investigation on the campus and multiple other investigations, including the NCAA, that this is going to go on for a long time. I believe other charges will be filed, and I think we're going to have Penn State on our minds and our newspapers, on our radios for years to come.
For years to come, wow. Laura, let me go back to you. Former Representative Steve Stettler was found guilty, I guess, yesterday. What was he found guilty of?
He was found guilty on six counts in the and this is the final phase of the so-called bonus gate trial. He was charged in that final round with Representative Bill DeWeese, who was also found guilty. And so his charges stemmed around theft, and I'm trying to find the rest of the list, but it was a similar sort of situation of using the state tax resources and time to campaign.
And this goes back, John, to when Tom Corbett was the Attorney General and began these investigations.
Yeah, that's right. It's a 5-year-old deal, and a lot of the problems that that these guys ended up facing were in front of a Dauphin County jury in very conservative central Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I remember going into one of the early trials, and as the jury filed in, just looking at the crowd, I leaned to a colleague and said, "Guilty."
Wow.
It's a tough time to be a politician, particularly in a largely rural conservative area.
Well, I noticed Ed Rendell was there as a character witness, but obviously wasn't able to sway the jury, John.
Well, he was a character witness for Vince Fumo, too, Marty, as you may recall, and that didn't turn out too well either.
No, and you had a piece recently about Vince Fumo, John.
Well, the feds are back. This is another case that's going to drag on for years. When Vince was first convicted back in 2009, he wrote a check for the restitution the government said he owed. It was like $2.3 million, paid it on the spot. And they keep coming back for first a longer jail term, which they got 6 months more. They wanted 20 years. Now they're back for another roughly $800,000 in money that they allege he stole from the citizens, that what was Citizens Alliance, the nonprofit group that he founded and ran, and was convicted of using mostly for his own pleasure in politics.
Laura, how far they have fallen when you think of Vince Fumo, John Prezel, DeWeese. I mean, these were powerful players in the Pennsylvania legislature.
Absolutely. Now, some of them were even rooming together in state prison. John Prezel and Bill DeWeese were roommates for a couple of weeks in Camp Hill State Prison across the river from Harrisburg. He's now been located to another prison where he'll serve the remainder of his term. But
do you think the legislature, people who work at the legislature, got the message that you can't mix politicking and governing?
I think there's an awareness when you talk to some folks. If you try and leave a message about a political question with some of these offices, people will tense up a little bit and say, "You gotta call the campaign office." And I think there's still an awareness. I mean, but you know, people do what people are going to do. I don't think there's a final solution to making sure that people follow the rules all the time.
What do you think, John?
I think it's always around, Marty. It's just that because it was ignored for so long, it got to ridiculous proportions, so those proportions will get rolled back. Mm-hmm. But look, public life and politics and government are all in one ball, and it's sometimes very tough to separate.
We're almost out of time here, John, but you had an interesting piece about Governor Corbett reducing spending on prisons and trying to reduce the prison population as well. Kind of a surprise move from a Republican.
Well, particularly, I mean, and the piece pointed out that the last time we had a Republican governor named Tom who had been a prosecutor, it was Tom Ridge, and he pushed for more prisons, mandatory sentencing, all kinds of laws to put violent criminals and nonviolent criminals away.
Yeah.
And now here we are doing exactly the opposite, trying to get people out of prison into community-based programs and canceling prisons. We started in 1980 with like 8 prisons. We now have 27. A couple more were on the books, and they've been put on hold. So you go one way for a while, Marty, and then you go another.
Well, my thanks to both of you, John Baer, Laura Olson, for joining us. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And John, thanks so much as well. Laura, Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. John Baer, political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. We have Robert Fields waiting in the wing, and we want to talk about the Supreme Court ruling today upholding the Affordable Care Act. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Chef Marcus Samuelson was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, and now runs one of New York's most celebrated restaurants in Harlem. On the next Fresh Air, he talks about the insults and abuse he faced training in some of Europe's elite restaurants and why it made him a better chef. Marcus Samuelson's new memoir is called Yes, Chef. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Hey, I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
We make the show Radiolab,
which is mostly a show just for your ears.
But not anymore. Because coming soon to the Kimmel Center's Academy of Music...
A very different kind of Radiolab.
Yeah, eyeballs dancing.
Astronauts sizzling.
Holy cow.
Blind men yelling.
Sultan, you are trying to impose a visual totalitarianism upon the human brain.
Join us for Radiolab Live June 29th. Details are at radiolab.org/inthedark.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The Supreme Court decides the fate of President Obama's health care law. We'll have the latest. Also, what's left on Congress's plate as it tries to get a jump on the 4th of July holiday. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that the 2010 Affordable Care Act is constitutional, giving the Obama administration's a big win over conservative critics who had argued that the health care overhaul was a step towards socialized medicine. I think many people were surprised about the ruling that came out about an hour ago. We asked Robert Field to join us. He's a professor of law at the Earl Mark School of Law, professor of health management and policy at the School of Public Health, both at Drexel University. And he happens to be joining us this morning from Switzerland for a reaction to the Supreme Court ruling. And Robert Field, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Glad to be able to join you.
And I should add that WHYY will air a special coverage from NPR as the president reacts to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the Affordable Care Act, and that's in about 15 minutes at noon. Robert Field, let me just begin with the response that I certainly had. I was surprised at the response. Were you?
I was indeed. I had predicted they'd strike down the mandate. I thought it would be a narrow ruling, but I didn't think the mandate would survive after having watched the questioning at the court the day it was discussed. In retrospect, there's actually some consistency here. The justices had been a lot more sympathetic to the argument that it's really a form of taxation rather than an expansion of the regulation of commerce. So if you draw a line back to that, you can see how Roberts might have had that feeling in his mind back when the arguments were presented. But, of course, hindsight is wonderful.
Sure.
We can draw the line back in time.
Help us understand, I guess, the difference between taxation as an argument and the Commerce Clause as an argument.
Yeah, they're completely different bases for what Congress has done. Congress has said that everyone has to have health insurance, and if you don't have a policy and you don't mean an exemption for religious or financial hardship reasons, then you pay an assessment which is added to your tax bill at the end of the year. You could see that as a tax.
Right.
It's in some ways analogous to saying that if you buy a hybrid car, you get a tax rebate. If you buy a regular car, you don't. It's just a question of what's assessed at the end of the year. You could also see this as a regulation on individuals saying, we're going to govern your behavior and telling you what you have to buy and under what circumstances. That would be under the Commerce Clause, which gives Congress the power to regulate whatever affects interstate commerce. Clearly, insurance affects interstate commerce. The court said clearly that this would not have stood under the Commerce Clause regulations. Justice Roberts said that there has to be some existing activity for Congress to regulate. In other words, it can't create the activity of buying insurance. But what Roberts did say in his opinion is if you look at it as a form of taxation, you have a choice. You pay the money to the insurance company, you pay the money to the IRS. That comes under Congress's power to levy new taxes, which is a very broad power that's been recognized all along. And so the mandate, if you want to call it that, or the tax assessment, stands.
And that's Robert Field. We called him up. He's actually in Switzerland to get reaction to the Supreme Court ruling earlier this morning upholding the Affordable Care Act. Any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert, was that the argument the Solicitor General made before the U.S. Supreme Court about this taxation issue?
It was one of three arguments he made. He started out saying that this was allowed under the Commerce Clause, that the fact that Congress was making you do something rather than regulating what you had already done was okay, that distinction wasn't meaningless. He was meaningless. He lost on that count. His next argument was that this was allowed under something called the Necessary and Proper Clause, that if Congress had the ability to regulate insurance because it's interstate commerce, they could do what was necessary and proper, and mandating that everybody buy coverage was necessary and proper. He lost on that one. But this was his third argument, that forget about this as a regulation. We're simply imposing a new form of taxation. You have a choice. You can comply with the law by paying the extra tax or by buying the insurance. He won on that one. It's not where they spent the most amount of time arguing in the hearings, but that didn't matter. He got his win is all that he really cares about.
And the fact that the Chief Justice seemed to be, because it's a 5-4 decision, seemed to be, maybe I won't call him the swing vote necessarily, but what's the significance of the Chief Justice weighing in on this and playing such an important role?
I think that's extremely significant because he really was the swing vote. Everyone had expected Justice Kennedy to be the swing vote, and he was actually a very strong dissenter. He was with the conservative group. The fact that Roberts was the one who joined the liberals in upholding the law says a lot about him, and there'll be a lot of analysis and thinking about what this means about Roberts. One possibility is he's been aware of the criticism of the court after the Citizens United case and some similar politically hot-button cases, and felt that he was afraid that this would be seen as another political decision and his court would be seen as overly political. So it's possible that that influenced him. It's also possible that he did see a narrow way to navigate this, to not uphold, not throw out an act of Congress, but at the same time not expand constitutional precedent.
Well, and obviously the significance of precedents, I guess, in this case, too.
Yes. Well, both sides were very concerned about the precedents that might emerge. The challengers to the law were afraid that this would be a ruling that said Congress can do virtually whatever it wants. You know, the infamous statement about how it could even make you buy broccoli, and that there'd be worse, Brussels sprouts, that there'd be no limit to what they could do. The supporters of the law were afraid that something else could happen. They were afraid that the court would significantly narrow Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce in general. For over 70 years since the New Deal, the court has granted Congress a lot of leeway to regulate anything that in any way regulates interstate involves interstate commerce. Even the home growing of wheat by a farmer in the Midwest, Congress could regulate that. They were afraid that this would mark a sea change in which the court started cutting back Congress's power and would make it very difficult for them to enact any kind of social legislation going forward. That didn't happen either.
I heard Lawrence Tribe, Harvard professor, actually had taught both President Obama and also Chief Justice John Roberts, predicting actually that the justice would decide with the more liberal members of the court and approve the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, well, I guess those who know him see a kind of a flexibility and an openness that hadn't been apparent recently, because he had been siding with the four other conservatives pretty consistently. But this is revealing something new about John Roberts, and it will be very interesting to speculate what this means in the court's next term.
And that's Robert Field, professor of law at the Earl Mark School of Law, professor of health management and policy at the School of Public Health. Those are both at Drexel University. And we called him up to join us to get his reaction to the decision earlier this morning, I should say. The Affordable Care Act is constitutional, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. If you have any questions or comments, it's a complicated issue, an important one indeed. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And do stay with us at noon. There'll be more on this, and it sounds like the president is going to talk about it as well. What role, so much of the focus, Robert, had been on this mandate, that was going to be the kind of key issue that was going to make or break the Affordable Care Act. How did the court weigh in on this particular issue?
On the mandate?
Yeah, the mandate itself.
There were actually two parts to the ruling. The one that everyone is going to remember is that it was upheld as a new form of taxation.
Right.
And so the headlines, you already see them on the news sites, Obamacare ruled constitutional. And that's the bottom line. It now goes forward. The exchanges will be set up. The consumer protections will go forward. The ability of people with pre-existing conditions to buy policies, all of that will go forward. There was another piece within that ruling that said that if you considered it as an exercise of the Commerce Clause authority, it would have been struck down. In that regard, Roberts was consistent with the four conservatives. So going forward, that is sort of a roadmap to Congress and also a warning that if they do pass new social legislation, they really won't be able to do a mandate if they rely on their commerce powers. Now, I don't think it's going to be that much of an issue because a mandate like this is pretty unusual. This has to do with the unique features of the insurance market, that you have to force everyone into the risk pool or else insurers can't spread the risk and they can't afford to provide the coverage. So I don't think it's going to happen that often, but it is a warning to Congress to be careful if something like this comes up again. On the other hand, it tells Congress that if you do something as a tax, if you give people a choice of buying broccoli or paying a tax or whatever, that will be upheld. There's another piece to this, which is the expansion of Medicaid. And half of the people to be newly covered will be newly covered under larger Medicaid programs in every state. The court upheld that for the most part, but with one important limitation. Congress could create a carrot to make it more enticing for states to cover more people. In other words, they fund 100% at first and then 90% of the additional cost. But what Congress can't do, according to the court, is to create a stick to tell states that if you don't go along with the expansion, we'll cut out funding for your entire Medicaid program from dollar one. They're not allowed to do that.
Well, and I guess that was part of why about half of the attorneys general were challenging this law.
Their major focus was the mandate, although they did bring Medicaid and the mandate into the equation. Their concern had to do, I think, with the overall thrust of the law and the balance of federal and state power. Because if you look at both the requirement that you buy insurance, the mandate, and the Medicaid expansion, that's Congress taking charge and saying this is how we're going to resolve the issue of the uninsured in America. And the states have the choice of going along with us or losing funding. I think that was their biggest concern.
Well, what's so interesting about the mandate, and I'm sure we've talked with you about this when you've been in the studio with us here in Philadelphia, which is the mandate was a conservative/Republican idea that was I won't say hatched, but was conceived of back in the 1990s, and yet here it is this issue that so many conservatives and Republicans seem to hate today.
Yeah, absolutely. There is this great political irony to all of this, and you could be cynical and say this is really just all politics, that the Constitution was secondary here, that the concerns over state versus federal power were all secondary, that this is just a question of partisanship. The mandate actually dates back to Richard Nixon. In 1973, he and his advisors considered basically Obamacare as a solution for the nation's health care problems. And we might have had it in 1973 if it hadn't been for Watergate. He got involved in Watergate and then was able to propose essentially nothing. It came up again in the late 80s when the Heritage Foundation, a very conservative, free market-oriented think tank, proposed using it to solve the problem of the uninsured. And then it was proposed again in 1993 by a group of Republicans, including Bob Dole, as an alternative to Clinton's plan. It came up again in 2006 when Romney used it in Massachusetts with strong, enthusiastic support from the Heritage Foundation and from many free market libertarian thinkers. And then there was a sort of quiet for a couple of years, and when Obama proposed the idea in 2009, the ground shifted. And many of the people who had been advocating it said that it was an encroachment on individual liberty, and it was unconstitutional, and it should not have been part of health reform. So there is a great political irony to where the sides are on this today.
And just to get into the weeds here, and I do want to get to some callers, in the primary, when it was Barack Obama against Hillary Clinton, she supported the mandate. He did not.
Yeah, that was interesting as well. And again, we had a reversal here, which you could see through cynical political eyes if you wanted to. Hillary adopted the Heritage Care, Romney Care approach for everyone. Obama said that he would have approved a mandate for children only, but not for the entire population. He never explained how that would work exactly, how you would solve the problems of the insurance market if only children had coverage and adults could go in and out of the risk pool, but that was his position. When he started putting his program together, he obviously relented and basically accepted Hillary's point of view that it should be a mandate for everyone.
Let me get to Chuck from Hopewell Township to join our conversation. And Chuck, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi, Mike.
Hi there.
Yeah, my perspective is that affordable care is a positive because the cliche, if you have your health, you have everything, rings true in this particular case. The American public has become more and more dependent upon corporate support for their well-being, and even though corporate support has slipped away and gone offshore, something needs to sustain the American public in their personal health situation.
Fair enough. Chuck, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Robert Field, about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, but I guess this mandate, the idea of increasing the pool, spreading the risk, making insurance more affordable, do you think going forward, and of course pieces of the Affordable Care Act have been put into place, other pieces to come, will we have a better health care system?
We'll have a more inclusive healthcare system, and in that regard, it will definitely be better. This law has so many moving parts, it's really difficult to predict. One thing to remember, though, in 1965, when they put Medicare into effect, no one had any idea if that would work. It was a massive crash effort by the government to put in this brand-new, unwieldy program into effect, and of course, today, the country couldn't live without it. So my guess is we're going to see a lot of good, we're going to see some bad, but it will sort itself out, and hopefully by the end of the decade, we will see a much better healthcare system.
Well, we've had you on hold for about a week or so, Robert Field. I'm glad we could talk. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure, Marty. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Robert Field, professor of law at the Earl Mack School of Law, also professor of health management and policy at the School of Public Health at Drexel University, actually joined us this morning from Switzerland, of all places. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be doing more about the healthcare plan tomorrow on the show as well.